This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
The goal of this podcast since day one is to provide the best information on the Vancouver real estate market at no cost to you, the listeners. To that end, we'd like to thank the following sponsors.
This podcast is sponsored by Marcon, a local family-owned and managed real estate development and construction company that's been around for nearly four decades. Marcon is not only committed to high-quality construction, but it also is making a positive impact in the communities in which it builds, all across the Lower Mainland.
We want to highlight two incredible Marcon projects. Elmwood, a 38-story tower located at Burquitlam's most important intersection, Como Lake Avenue and Clark Road. This landmark tower will feature 335 condominiums, over 37,000 square feet of office and retail space, and almost 20,000 square feet of amenity space. Elmwood has been incredibly popular with 80% sold currently, but they still have a great selection of junior one-bedroom all the way to three-bedroom homes remaining. Check out marcon.ca/elmwood for more.
And Matt, we are also excited about Soane House, Marcon's newest community in West Coquitlam, with 165 homes ranging from junior one beds to three beds. Soane House offers the perfect West Coast aesthetic with a more nuanced Nordic-inspired design. Register today at marcon.ca/soanehouse. That's S-O-E-N-H-A-U-S. Or you can learn more at marcon.ca or follow them at Instagram at Marcon Homes.
Marcon, building for life.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
Matt, I'm excited for today because we have Emily Hamilton coming out of the United States of America.
That's right.
She's a research fellow and director of the Urbanity Project at Mercatus Center, George Mason University.
That's right.
This is going to be a swell episode.
This is a great episode. And really what we invited Emily on to talk about was, we've talked a lot about the problems of single family zoning in places like Vancouver and how it's exclusionary and how there's not enough housing, there's a housing crisis. Emily is looking at places across the U.S. that have actually rezoned all the single family zoning, places like Minneapolis where they've went into duplex and fourplex zoning, which has been celebrated by a lot of people. I think that we've had on in the past would say that's a smart move. Emily's saying, look, that's not actually enough.
Right.
And there's problems with that. So stay tuned for what those problems are. And zoning might not be the answer.
Before we get to our chat with Emily, Matt, we do have some stats that were just released. We should talk about it.
Well, yeah, this
some
is
interesting this findings.
This is September stats, right?
Yes.
September was a bit of was a busy one. There's no question about that.
For sure. For sure. My kid went back to a nanny share.
Actually,
started playing tennis. It's been an exhausting month, but it's also been busy for the market.
Yeah. The market was busy too.
You started riding your bike to work.
I started riding my bike to work. I went golfing once. Yeah. What else did I do?
Yeah.
Finished two puzzles.
Yeah. And you're working on Ted Lasso.
Yeah, exactly. It's been a very busy couple weeks.
For sure. But no, we're joking. It's been busy in the market. It's been very busy in the market, and we've been extremely busy. And here's some interesting stats right now, because if you were wondering, a lot of people, and we've talked about this on the program before, but if you're kind of scratching your head and going, I wonder if this whole COVID thing has forced many to reevaluate living in the city and maybe looking elsewhere to beautiful places to live. You can think of like secondary markets or more kind of like resort homes.
Right.
The answer,
like we talked a lot about Squamish earlier in the year.
Sure. Yeah. And also small towns in BC, your Nelsons and that sort of thing. But check out this stat. This is taken directly from the September stats. We've got the Sunshine Coast over the last 6 months has gone up nearly 15% home prices.
Now, is that single family homes on the Sunshine Coast?
That is residential across the board. But yeah,
wow.
Mostly single family homes. I think there's a lot of townhomes on the Sunshine Coast as well. Island.
Wait a second, though. That is
staggering. It's staggering.
That is staggering. Wow.
That's what a lot of markets would do in like 5 years, right?
Yeah.
So like that's a very staggering number. Bowen Island is up 16.6% in the past 6 months. Think about that.
So these are places basically that are commuter. Sure. To Vancouver, but not commuting every day. You know, you can live on Bowen. You don't want to come in five days a week.
Come in once a week.
But yeah, once or twice a week, easy. That is incredible. Those are incredible numbers.
Yeah, and I think, and I'm just curious, because I mean, we've had clients heading to Nanaimo, to the area around Nanaimo, like your Qualcomm Beach kind of location.
Yeah.
We've also had clients going to Victoria and kind of surrounding areas as well. So, You see a lot of people going to Vancouver Island. I would imagine that that market's on fire too. We should definitely bring somebody on to talk about what's happening there.
Yeah, good idea.
But really, like, just think of that. Sunshine Coast, Bowen Island. We've also had a lot of activity in the Vancouver market. And I'm just going to give a quick summary.
Please
here
do.
Of kind of what's going on. We'll start with the detached on the west side. It is a seller's market right up to $3.5 million.
So and it's busy over there, right? You were at an open house last week and you said was lined up down the
70,
street.
70 groups through at a house. I mean, priced competitively for sure. Multiple offer type scenario, but 70 groups coming through over the course of the weekend. And you can imagine it's a pain because you got to have spaced out the intervals.
Yeah,
so everybody
right.
has to wait
to
go
minutes,
in. So
right?
there's actually literally a lineup around the block. And that lineup is there for a long time because you got people spending, you know, 10 minutes inside the house, right?
Yeah.
So it's an interesting time, but that market's been busy. The most active price band on the west side for detached is still very much kind of the entry level options at $2.25 to $2.5 million.
Of course.
Yeah. In that market, half of the homes are selling. It's basically a 50% sales ratio, which is crazy. It's a very, very busy market. Looking at the attached on the west side, a seller's market up to $1.25 million. Kits, again, is the front runner. Kits is on fire right now. One out of every two homes is selling in Kitsilano. Super busy market again.
Yeah, I feel like Kits for the last maybe close to a year, year and a half, seems to just be going bananas. But what's going on the east side?
So on the east side, in the detached market, right up to $2.5 million is a seller's market. So, I mean, it's right across the board. It was a lot of the times we've talked about activity in the detached market, we were kind of talking more entry mid-level. And now, I mean, like really, right up to new construction, higher end homes on the east side,
right.
Stuff's turning over. We've got Fraser is at 60% sales ratio, or as some people call it, Fraser Hood.
Right,
Hood. I'm not one of
the
those people.
The Hood to Fraser, yeah.
I still call it Fraser. But anyways, it is a 60% sales ratio. Main Street, 93% sales ratio.
Just
stuff just
bananas.
Yeah, absolutely. But you've got a house in the Main Street corridor, you are sitting pretty.
I was at an inspection the other day with an inspector, a very good inspector that we speak to a lot, Darren Larder, and he was saying he inspected a home, a pre-inspection Main Street corridor a few days ago. There was another inspector there at the same time. There's two pre-inspections the day before as well.
Right.
So that's at least four pre-inspections for that house. Crazy times. Crazy times on the Main Street corridor for single family.
For sure. Crazy time for single family all across the board. Attached in East Vancouver, it's a seller's market up to $1.5 million. Super busy. And, you know, a lot of townhomes getting absorbed. People looking for more space, I think, is a lot of what's driving this. Cheap rates.
Well, yeah. And I just had somebody get a 1.79, and that was an uninsured mortgage. Wow. So, yeah. I mean,
most rates are coming in with a one as the first number, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And then moving over to the attached market on the east side, we have a seller's market up to 1.5 million. Homes selling on average 100% of their list price. So again, even the attached market in East Van, really, really busy right now. A lot of townhomes getting absorbed, half duplexes getting absorbed. It, generally speaking,
not a lot of room for negotiation there.
Well, no, there's not. And but you know what? There's still opportunities, of course, but people are generally, I think, looking for more space, looking to capitalize on low interest rates. And there's a lot of activity in the market. Last but not least, we got to talk about downtown.
Yeah, let's talk about downtown.
Yeah, so downtown is the most interesting of the lot in Vancouver's proper, right?
Yeah.
Because it's a balanced market almost across the board. Moderate seller's market in some price bands, and even a buyer's market in other price bands as you get higher up in your purchase price.
Well, I feel like for years we said, you know, think about the Vancouver real estate market like a pond where you drop the rock in downtown and it kind of waves out from there, right?
Sure.
And now it feels like if you had to say just Vancouver proper specifically, downtown is the area that feels slower than almost any other of the kind of surrounding areas around downtown.
Sure. But picture yourself being a historian now in 30 years.
Okay.
And you're looking back and you're first of all, you've got the Dewey Decimal System figured out and you're trying to find the book on Vancouver real estate in the year 2020.
Right.
And you want to see what the impact of COVID-19 is on the market. Do these stats not tell a story that seems quite accurate here?
There's been what I would say is that a lot of the predictions early on seem to have come true and if anything are growing right now, right?
So like there seems like fear perhaps of maybe vertical living.
Yeah. Density is not of the day.
Right. Downtown right now is not looking its best. Some might argue, Sam Sullivan specifically. There's a lot of crime going on. There's some of the pain points in this city are now more visible than ever.
I feel like the fissures are now fractures.
Yes. Well put. And as you start to go across the Lower Mainland, you're starting to see people looking for space. They don't mind. They can work from home. They don't have to commute. But then on top of that, though, like these Sunshine Coast numbers, these Bowen Island numbers, presumably what's happening. I know that there's a lot of activity right now in the detached market in areas like Victoria and stuff. I think COVID has kind of forced people's hands to pull back and say, let's reevaluate. Like, right. Let's look inwards and try and figure out what we're going to do in our lives.
Right. And the big question here is how long does this last?
Right.
I mean, is this something where we'll be talking about 5, 7, 10 years from now and saying, yeah, I mean, that was it. We sort of had a shift in direction that continued on, or will it be kind of a year or two blip?
Well, there's this thing that I've been doing where I keep thinking that things are going to go back to how they were at some point.
Right.
And then the things that we were excited about before, urban centers, vibrant urban centers, hugging each other and going to crowded nightclubs in Yale Town,
yep.
Whatever, things that we used to do all the time around here at the Vancouver Real Estate.
A lot of hugging at nightclubs.
At nightclubs specifically. I can't even remember the last time I've been to a nightclub.
Or last week.
No mask. No, just kidding. No. But this is the thing. I don't know if it will go back to normal. And the reason I say that is because there's all these studies now saying that a lot of companies are realizing that people are more productive working from home, which is shocking to me because I'm not one of those people.
I feel like you and I are actually in that debate, though. I feel like we keep shouting that and everybody else keeps going, oh, yeah, whatever. And then they go back to just believing that they're more productive.
Well, no, but you know what it is, though, is they're actually, yeah, like I was talking to a woman the other day, her firm has been analyzing the data, and they think that people are more productive at home because people feel guilty, I think, and they work longer.
Oh, right. There's no boundaries. The boundaries are gone.
The boundaries, yeah. They'll take an email at 9 o'clock or a call or whatever, which is kind of horrible for probably burnout and mental health and all those things. Everyone's just turned into a realtor.
Netflix at lunch.
Yeah. But work at Netflix time. That's the thing. Everything's been flipped on its head. But I don't know. My point is that will things go back to the trends that they were at, or has this created a fundamental shift in our thinking and the way we work and operate as a society where we're going to see people – like I don't think the city's going to die. I think it's far from that. But I do think that – you know, it's not surprising. I think people will want more space almost in anticipation of if something like this happens again. It'll be like stacking money under your mattress in the Great Depression.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know what? And that's actually a useful way to think about it, right? That the grandma that made you finish everything because that's how it was in 1933. Yeah. But one last thought here, because where I see the weakness in the market is, and we've talked about this before as well, is it's kind of not only we're sort of thinking about this almost entirely from an end user perspective, but investors have really, really stopped looking for real estate in the last 6 months. Like that is the other thing. And I feel like that there's so much investor activity in downtown and the surrounding areas. And when with rents on the decline, first of all, like cash flow was tough in Vancouver 8 months ago. It's worse now. Right. So there's that kind of factor. And then just the uncertainty around actually being able to cash rent checks. It's really shifted the a wait and see approach is an understatement for a lot of those investors. And that kind of component of the market is just feels really, I mean, that's almost half the market downtown in my experience. So,
yeah,
you know, it's just, I'm just thinking about that as well. It's like we've removed a huge segment of the buying public as well. So these numbers look even more accurate to the predictions of 6 months ago, but just laying on another component here.
Yeah. And you know what? Well, the rental market is getting clobbered right now.
Yeah.
And it's really tough, especially for landlords that only have a couple doors where if they're losing a tenant right now, it's going to be probably really hard to recreate the rent you were getting a year or two ago. And I don't think a lot of people that haven't had to lease a place recently have realized that. Like there's a lot of people that have reached out and said, you know, should I be increasing my rent right now?
Yeah.
You know, asking and I mean, of course, we're not property managers, but I would think long and hard about
you don't want to lose.
You want to accommodate your tenant right now, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely
the case. For sure. But so, I mean, it is an interesting time. What do you buy? If you're looking in the rental market, I'm buying something with a den. I'm buying something with good outdoor space.
I just had this conversation yesterday morning about, you know, used to be cheap and cheerful, get the smallest unit possible. I feel like most of the people that I've helped purchase in the last 6 months who were renting before are almost exclusively looking for 650, and they're usually couples, but 650 plus.
Right.
And they need either a smaller two-bed or a one and den, and the den has to be like not like, oh, it's internal storage. It has to be
for sure
a place where they can work from home. So I feel like if that's on the real estate side, on the purchasing side, undoubtedly the rental market's moving that way, at least for the short term. And that could be a long-term trend, right? I'm not sure the studio is necessarily what I'd be looking for right now.
And so I guess just to kind of recap here, if you are someone that owns a property right now, whether you own it and live in it or you own it as a rental and it has many rooms, decent square footage, good outdoor space, and a front door.
Yeah.
You're probably in a good spot.
You're in a good spot. And the other thing is that I was talking to somebody whose tenant was leaving the other day, and the tenant was looking for more space. It was a couple. In a one bedroom, they needed more space. They were both working from home, I guess going a little bit crazy. But what this landlord pointed out that the tenant told them, which I thought was actually an interesting point, is they're not leaving their place as much. They're not spending as much money. They have more money for rent, right? That's the other thing, right? If you have X amount of money for rent, but you're eating out at lunch every day, you're commuting downtown, and now you're at home, well, suddenly you got a couple $100 more for rent,
sure,
if required, for that extra space that's going to make your life better.
Exactly, exactly. And Matt, we've been talking for a while. So
I was
going to
say that was a bit of an impromptu conversation.
Why don't we chat about our sponsor this week and last week and hopefully next week, Oakwind Realty.
That's right, Oakwind Realty. This is our real estate brokerage here in Vancouver, one of the top 200 growing companies in Canada, which is an incredible thing. I put it on the culture, great culture. Really focused on education and knowledge there, not to mention just a really nice group of people. Head over to oakwind.com/join, type in VRP 2020 if you want to find out more about what Oakwind's doing. This is, of course, for agents, aspiring agents, seasoned agents, people looking to make a change. Oakwind.com join VRP2020. Tell them we sent you. There's a huge incentive specifically for members of the VRIP community.
Yeah, they're big on alliteration. They call it the Scalina surprise. It's a huge one. it's like your waistline. It's a
surprise.
Huge,
here's my big waistline.
Yeah, it's a huge surprise. It's Matt's belt.
And two things more before we get to our really good conversation with Emily. One is some listeners probably remember some months past we were calling out people. We were looking to grow our team. Oakland has Oakland University. We have the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast University. Right. It's basically a 3-month grinding program for any one of the successful candidates.
Yeah.
We have a recent graduate. Even though she's been in real estate more than a decade, she was through this grinding process. And Ava Benesaki is a new member of our team, and we just wanted to shout out.
We're going
to
bring her
to
on.
Ava. She'll be on the show.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's great to have Ava on the team. And yeah, look for her on the show for sure.
Absolutely, Matt. I wonder if the huge surprise is your ego just in a box.
Surprise.
Surprise. But without further ado, let's cut to our interview with Emily Hamilton.
Enjoy.
Okay, so we're here with Emily Hamilton, Director of the Urbanity Project and Research Fellow at Mercatus Center, George Mason University. How you doing, Emily?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Very well. Yeah, thanks so much for taking the time today, Emily.
Thank you. It's great to be talking with you.
So can you maybe start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm a housing economist at the Mercatus Center. And I work primarily on regulatory issues that are standing in the way of more housing being built at lower costs in order to allow more people to live in the locations where they want to live, in types of neighborhoods that match their preferences, and where their own best opportunities are located. Right now, lots of regulations are standing in the way of more of the type of housing that people want from being built, particularly in some of the highest cost parts of the United States. And it's causing huge problems, both for individuals who are struggling to afford housing and for the country as a whole, because when people can't live where they would like to, that often means that they are not making the type of economic contributions that they'd be able to if they were able to afford housing where they would like to live.
Interesting. So part of the reason we wanted to bring you on, Emily, is because you recently wrote an article called "Want More Housing? Ending Single Family Zoning Won't Do It." And this was published in Bloomberg City Lab. Why did you write this article?
Yeah, I wrote it because there's been a big emphasis in the U.S. on ending single-family zoning, which is absolutely something I would stand behind. I don't think there's any reason not to allow people to live in denser housing configurations if they would like to. But there's been so much focus on single-family zoning that some of the other land use regulations that are also standing in the way of more lower cost housing, I don't think are getting the attention that they need. In a lot of parts of the US, and I think in Canada as well, there are really large minimum lot size requirements. And so thinking about, a duplex or a fourplex on a 2-acre lot or something is just kind of silly. It's not a housing configuration that makes a lot of sense. And then in some of the places where there has been reform on the single family zoning issue, Minneapolis, most famously with its 2019 abolition of single family zoning, there haven't been reforms to go along with that to make it easier to build more units on a single lot. So prior to 2019, Minneapolis had many lots where only a detached single-family house would have been allowed. And now triplexes are allowed. But most of the land area that was previously single family zoning has a height limit below three stories. So that right there rules out something like triple deckers, which we see a lot of in New England, where you have three units that are all good sized, stacked right on top of each other. Then additionally, there are setback requirements and floor area ratio constraints in Minneapolis that I think may make it difficult to build triplexes, even though they are now allowed. And in fact, it's been close to a year now that triplexes have been permitted, and so far only three have been permitted. Now, of course, that's a short time in the world of real estate development, and there's a pandemic going on, so things may get much better down the road. But I think so far it's been a little bit disappointing how difficult it still may be to build triplexes in Minneapolis.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because we've had a lot of, I feel like we've had past guests on that, you know, there's a Abundant Housing Vancouver organization here, and we've had them on the show previously, and they're calling for basically the same thing that happened in Minneapolis, the abolition of single family zoning here in Vancouver. And that was really celebrated, but it sounds like there's a bunch of kind of hidden regulatory measures at work here that make it very hard to do much else than single family zoning.
That's right. And to be clear, I think there's a lot to celebrate among Minneapolis policymakers and activists who got through what's still a radical change to allow the city to accommodate more people in a denser housing typology. But this very narrow focus on single family zoning obscures some of the other regulations that make denser types of housing still difficult to build.
And I'm always kind of curious, and it's one of those questions that might be difficult to answer, but, you know, after reading, you know, I was one of these guys that celebrated this move in Minneapolis as well. But after reading your argument here, your piece, it seems so obvious. Like, why would they, I guess, why in your mind would they focus on the zoning when there's all sorts of regulations that basically make it a moot point? Like, was that just an oversight, or is it to kind of appease NIMBYs in Minneapolis? Or that's more of a cynical read. But why do you think they overlooked that all the regulatory constraints?
I think there are a couple reasons. In the U.S., single family zoning has a very ugly racist history as being a policy that the Federal Housing Administration suggested that localities should implement in order to keep their neighborhoods segregated, because the federal government felt that it would be safer to insure mortgages in neighborhoods that were white only, and they thought that single family zoning would help achieve that in the neighborhoods where they wanted to insure mortgages. So, you know, with a history like that, absolutely, we should be getting rid of these rules that continue to have racist effects today. But then to your point about it being kind of a compromise, city council members in Minneapolis very much sold this reform as something that wouldn't really change the look of Minneapolis neighborhoods from the outside. There was a quote from a politician there that was something like, it's the same box, that single family house, but now it can accommodate three households rather than one. But where we see lots of infill development, it's often not the same box. It's a larger box that's now accommodating more households. There are certainly exceptions. Brownstone neighborhoods, for example, can be chopped up into apartments, and it can work really well there. But in a lot of cases, especially when we're talking about detached single-family houses on large lots, it makes more sense to build a larger structure to accommodate more units rather than just chopping up what's there into smaller units.
Do you think, you know, I guess backing up here, like we've been doing this podcast for the last 5 years or so, and I feel like in Vancouver specifically, and I guess more generally in North America, there's always this push and pull argument around supply and demand. Do you think cities generally are overregulated? Or to put it another way, is the solution here, like and we'd love to hear more about Houston, which you use as an example, but is the solution kind of open things up, let builders build, less regulation, market-based solutions type thing?
That's my opinion, yes. I think cities are very much overregulated. It's too difficult to get new housing proposals approved in many cases. And also just the rules on the book don't allow enough housing to be built for many of the regions where people most want to live. And direct housing construction often to the most expensive type of detached single family housing rather than allowing a denser, lower cost, more walkable types of development to be built easily. And when we look at within the U.S. of the cities that are less regulated, Texas cities in particular have been very welcoming of growth and housing construction relative to coastal cities in the U.S. And they have experienced extremely rapid population growth while generally remaining relatively affordable, in many cases more affordable than the median house price in the U.S.
Just thinking about Texas maybe, you know, so like where has Houston really got it right as a city?
Well, Texas cities generally are thought of for their new greenfield development, and they certainly do plenty of that. But if we look at the large cities in Texas, they also permit lots of large multifamily projects and townhouses as well. And Houston is a really interesting case of a reform designed to permit more infill development. In 1999, the city reduced its minimum lot size from 5,000 square feet down to effectively 1,400 square feet. And that has a similar effect as moving from single family zoning to triplex zoning, because now the REIT houses can be built where just one was permitted previously. And this has led to some cool infill townhouses in Houston, especially in the neighborhoods closest to downtown. And Houston is a really interesting case because it's never had use zoning. It does have land use regulations that we would typically see in the zoning ordinances of other localities. So lot sizes, obviously, parking requirements, other restrictions on density. But not having use zoning means that townhouses in many cases have replaced single family houses, but they've also been built in some industrial areas where housing was now a better use of land rather than industrial. So that's a whole area of housing restrictions, use zoning, that Houston has just never had. That's different from Minneapolis or lots of other cities.
And just to be clear, when you say use zoning, like it sounds like Houston, you can literally just use land for whatever you want.
Yes.
Am I getting that right?
Yeah, they don't have residential or commercial or industrial. Yes, definitely. And that's been put to a vote in Houston 3 times and voted down all 3 times.
So potentially you could just to kind of play this out, on a residential street in the suburbs, if somebody wanted to build a
shooting
auto,
range.
Yeah, or an auto body shop. Right. Like they could put that in the middle of the block and if it works, it works, and that's just the way it goes.
Yeah, they could. And there are definitely a few instances of uses next to each other that you wouldn't expect to see in Houston. But on the whole, in terms of patterns of where industrial uses are located, it doesn't look much different than other, relatively newly developed Sunbelt cities that are very car oriented, like Houston. So we see land prices doing a lot of the work of determining where different uses are located, that zoning codes are doing in other places.
And presumably also, like, if there's commercial districts or where more businesses are, you would likely want to put a business close to other businesses.
There's the contours of, like
market forces,
the streams that create these flows that make sense, I guess, where you wouldn't do something too radical. But just thinking about Houston as well here, like Houston, reminds me at least, and I've never been to Houston, but it reminds me of cities in Canada, like say Calgary, where there's a lot of sprawl. It's kind of a more of a car culture than say a city like Vancouver or San Francisco. Like it sounds like your idea of density actually is kind of more walkable, more dense neighborhoods that I think a lot of us like to live in. Does that kind of just wide open market approach lead to sprawl in your mind in places like Houston? Has that contributed?
Great question. So first off, I definitely agree with your premise that a lot of people prefer denser, more walkable neighborhoods, and that people with those preferences are currently underserved. I've done some research on the price premium for more walkable neighborhoods in the U.S., and I find that people pay more to live in more walkable parts of regions, holding lots of other things constant. And I think that's due to land use regulations that, number one, make it really difficult to build new walkable neighborhoods, and number two, tend to make it really difficult to add housing to neighborhoods that are already walkable. I don't necessarily think that a more market-driven outcome prevents walkability, because if we look at older cities that are often where the most walkable neighborhoods are located, those were very much built without zoning, certainly, and right, in many cases with hardly any land use regulations at all. But in the context of cars being, so much more prevalent, the way so many people get around today, I think it's not realistic to expect something like Lower Manhattan to be built from scratch today. But Houston, for example, has lots of government interventions that have shaped what it looks like, even though it doesn't have use zoning. So it has high parking requirements, for example, although there have been some recent reforms to get rid of parking requirements there in some neighborhoods, but its development pattern is very much shaped by high parking requirements, as well as, of course, tons of highway building, which both makes it difficult to make pleasant, walkable neighborhoods in more central locations, but also very much subsidizes people who want to live in farther flung, less walkable parts of the region, but still drive into downtown.
Really interesting. So Emily, one of the things we've kind of been talking about on the podcast, and we've had lots of planners on over time, and talking about just what seems to be an incredible demand to live in urban centers. And obviously recently with COVID, we've kind of watched that notion kind of be turned on its head a bit, just with people, at least in our marketplace, kind of leaving the downtown core in a lot of cases, buying further out, getting more space, especially now that they can work from home, they don't have to commute. And we're also seeing like recreation resort towns kind of booming right now outside of the Vancouver region. Is this a trend that you guys, is it on your radar? Is it something that you're considering? Is it something that you're monitoring in the U.S.?
It seems at least as well, just to piggyback on what Adam's saying, like New York City, I feel like the New York Times has reported on this a bunch, that everybody's leaving the city.
The city, yeah. And do you think this is, and just as a follow-up, do you think this is kind of a short-lived circumstance, or do you see buying habits or where people prefer to live actually changing as a result of COVID?
That's a question that's definitely on my radar, but I don't know if the short-term trends will be long-lasting or not. Certainly, lots of high-income people are leaving New York City for, you know, the Hamptons or wherever they might be able to afford a house. Similarly, in the U.S., like mountain towns are seeing tons of new demand for housing there. I think that it's likely that trends we were already seeing in terms of more people working remotely and working for themselves from home will likely be accelerated by COVID. People who, you know, may have been pretty averse to doing video calls or otherwise working remotely have been forced to get more comfortable with those technologies and carry out their jobs in that way. So it's likely that some people and some firms who would not have been open to remote work previously have changed their stance on that permanently, I think. But in terms of how big that transition will be, I think it's very much unknown. I'm very much a believer in cities and think that the innovation and chance meetings between people who work, you know, at maybe different firms in the same industry or in complementary industries, and face-to-face communication are really key to particularly lots of knowledge sector jobs. And I don't think that can fully be replicated online, but, you know, it's a very unprecedented situation, and I, you know, wouldn't want to bet money on any certain outcome. Although, actually, I do have a bet out on on what will happen to rents in New York 3 years from now. Oh. So you can
wait. We'd love to. First off, how much and what was the bet? You don't have to say how much, but what was your what are you betting on?
My claim is that real rents, median rent in New York City will be the same or higher in 3 years than it is today. So we'll see.
Interesting. In the context, of course, for those listening who haven't been following rents in New York, but I think it's similar to Vancouver and Toronto here in Canada, is that in the last six months, vacancy rates have, of course, increased and the rents are actually down this year, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Wow. And, you know, it's interesting because I was just speaking to a property manager yesterday who downtown Vancouver for the same one bedroom had to drop the price 25% from what they were getting this time last year. So substantial decreases in rents kind of throughout the city core right now. So
certainly. Yeah. And from what I've seen, it seems to be that high-end, you know, newer, fancier buildings are seeing the largest declines with less of a movement among lower cost, older buildings. But yeah, we'll see. I could very well be wrong and lose that bet.
It's an interesting, I think I'd go with you on that one, but not that it matters all that much. But hopefully, you win your money on that. So we're before we went live we just talked. The first presidential election happened last night, and we kind of briefly touched on that. I guess just as a jumping off point, you mentioned you were watching it with hopes that housing would be mentioned. I think Canada and the U.S. are similar in that the major, especially coastal cities, but I guess Toronto would be thrown in there, have faced increasing housing costs for, you know, the last decade at least. It's become really almost untenable. Are you optimistic that this missing middle will actually emerge in the next say 5, 10, 15 years? Like, are we going to get this right? Can we make these reforms? And presumably there was no, I don't think I heard anything about housing at the federal level. So I think it's more of a municipal approach has to be taken anyway. But what are your thoughts there?
I'm much more optimistic now than I was several years ago. When I first started working on urban policy issues, it seemed so clear to me that homeowners have so much influence at the local level, especially those who are vehemently opposed to change, relative to renters who, you know, may not even live in the jurisdiction where they want to because they can't afford it, who are unrepresented in local politics. But seeing some of the reforms at both the state and the local level in the U.S. have made me much more optimistic. And in Vancouver with the laneway houses as another example of policymakers recognizing that housing affordability is a growing burden for their constituents and being willing to take steps that may be controversial, may not be, you know, universally liked moves to make more housing at lower prices easier to build. Within the U.S., I'm especially optimistic about states stepping in and setting limits on the extent to which their localities can stand in the way of housing. California has been a real leader on that front, likely because they have the most severe housing affordability problems in the U.S. But there has been a lot of energy at the state level, not just in California, but in several states across the U.S., proposing and in some cases passing legislation that's setting limits on things like single-family zoning, on bans against accessory dwelling units, and making it easier to build, particularly those missing middle, gentle density types of solutions.
And maybe as a final question, Emily, like not to put too fine a point on it here, but for places like California where the state seems to be taking a more active role, like can we just talk a little bit about what is at risk if we don't get this right in certain areas of North America where housing has just become, you know, out of the realm of the possible for so many people?
Yeah, in California, there are lots of small municipalities that are just incredibly wealthy, and their residents and their politicians may be fine with the status quo. You know, they see everyone around them who's affluent and doing well and securely housed. But then there's just this extreme disparity when we go to nearby jurisdictions where homelessness rates are reaching new heights all the time. And so many people who are renters or owners are just incredibly burdened by the amount of their income that they have to spend to remain housed each month. And California has already lost some major employers to lower cost states because these employers, you know, obviously since they located in California, that was their first choice. But as they're having more trouble attracting and retaining employees because of the insane cost of housing, they're saying, you know, let's relocate to Texas or Colorado or somewhere where our employees can have a better quality of life because they won't be having to spend so much of their income on housing. And it's possible that if California isn't able to get its housing affordability problems under control, this could cause serious problems for state and local governments down the road, because things like public employee pension systems depend on a certain level of population and population growth in order to have enough revenue to continue funding them. If California were to see large population losses, it would mean serious trouble for their fiscal condition.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we'll leave it there, Emily, but how can people find out more about what you're doing and also, of course, the Mercatus Center?
Most of my research is available at Mercatus, that's MERCATUS.org. And I'm pretty active on Twitter. I'll always tweet out new op-eds or studies that I have. And my handle is EBW Hamilton.
And we'll also, of course, link to your article that caught our attention, Want More Housing, Ending Single Family Zoning Won't Do It in Bloomberg City Lab, which was a really interesting read. And yeah, great conversation. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much. It was great talking with you.
Yeah, and enjoy the rest of the debates.
Ooh.
Oh, gosh.
I was going to say, I'm not even sure what's worse, being on Twitter or watching the debates. But
try watching the debates while on Twitter.
Yeah,
at the same time.
Yeah, at the same time is the answer. It's like the companion piece.
Yeah, no kidding. Sucker for punishment.
Yeah.
Well, enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks so much, Emily.
Thank you. You too.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with Emily Hamilton, the director of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University.
Really enjoyed that conversation with Emily, Matt, and always insightful to have somebody who's kind of looking into planning and density, because obviously that's a pain point in the city of Vancouver.
A pain point here, a pain point across North America, and it's what I really liked about this was there's two things, really. One is that she's looking at different cities and how they're approaching it and how we can learn from each other, right? As one kind of interesting takeaway there. And the second, places like Minneapolis, I remember when they rezoned the entire city at once and it was like, bam, housing crisis over. And sure, of course, Emily's saying, not so fast, not so simple. Those are kind of big splashy wins, but the devil's in the details.
I want to know, like, anyone who's visited Japan, like, one thing I remember about Tokyo is that there do not seem to be any zoning requirements.
I remember you saying
whatsoever.
That. Yeah.
It's like the buildings are, there's like super tall buildings on really tiny lots. And then there's also like encroachments everywhere and buildings that touch. And it's just bizarre. But I know that they've relaxed zoning significantly as well. It would be interesting to talk to somebody about Japan as well.
Well, let's make that happen.
Yeah, we should make that happen. But what else do we got for the day? Oh, and you should have asked Emily more about U.S. politics.
Because, you know what? We did. Well, we
our
asked,
Van Pauly podcast.
Yeah, we did. We did. This is interesting because she lives in Washington, D.C., and we just said to her before we went live, like, what's life like right now? Like,
yeah.
I feel like that you can feel the tension coming over the border. And I think specifically she said Black Lives Matter, like those protests were – the city was just like, I don't know. God, talk about anxiety. Right. It must be brutal. And of course the
– And the debates.
The debates are tonight. Vice presidential debates are tonight. So we got Pence versus Harris.
Right.
This is going to be a good one.
And SNL is back in studio.
That's right. That's right.
And did you see the Jim Carrey skit as Joe Biden?
I did. Yeah.
Alrighty then. So what else do we have for today, Matt?
We got a few things. One, we didn't even talk about the Sellers Club in the intro. I feel like we got so deep into this conversation about changes in the housing market that we forgot about the most exclusive new club in all of Vancouver. That's the VREP Sellers Club.
No mask required. This is an incredible club. It will take you back to the old days of 70s disco clubs.
That's right. This is like, what is that club called?
Club 54.
Club 54. This is the new normal.
Yeah, this is a great club to be a part of. It is the Sellers Club. At the Sellers Club, you get the best resources for selling your home for top dollar in the shortest amount of time. It'll make you feel like you're partying with a couple of rock stars, because in reality, you are.
That's right. You are. And these are actionable plans, right? This isn't wishy-washy stuff. This is taking you from A to Z to get your property sold for top dollar in the shortest amount of time. You want to be a member of the Sellers Club. There's no question about it. Last but not least, we have private client services. And this, of course, is at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Yeah, Matt, because if you are not using PCS, you are standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, days on market. You basically get realtor level information. It's free. It's at your fingertips. It is the best way to look for real estate in Vancouver. Trust me, we have looked at every way to look, and this is just, it's the simplest.
It's the simplest. It's the best. You get realtor level information.
It's amazing.
There is no reason why you shouldn't be using private client services. If you want to talk about that, zoning, selling, U.S. politics, whatever, give me a call, 778-847-2854 or matt@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And if you want to talk about SNL, give me a call, 778-866-4574 or adam@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
We also got that secret line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And that's a line if you want to talk turkey, tofurkey.
Oh, right. Yeah. It's Thanksgiving.
Vegan jerky.
It's vegan jerky.
Yeah. He'll talk about all of his best-kept vegan Thanksgiving treats.
And he's a meat eater. But yeah. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone, and we'll be back next week.
Take care.
2,000 Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.
Hey everyone, pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible.
This podcast is sponsored by Common Ground Consulting.
Are you developing in the Lower Mainland? Common Ground Consulting is a development management and consulting company with experience in single family, townhouses, multifamily, and commercial developments.
What I love about Common Ground, Adam, is they manage the whole development process, from due diligence and feasibility reports for initial purchase of land to completing rezoning, development permits, and building permits.
They streamline the whole process with strong relationships with sub-consultants and municipalities and a deep understanding of all city requirements.
Common Ground Consulting. Feasibility and efficiency prioritized every step of the way.
Learn more at commonground-consulting.com or 604-807-6419.
We are also sponsored by Oakwin Realty. This is our real estate brokerage, best brokerage in the city, hands down. If you are in the industry, a new agent, an aspiring agent, somebody just looking to make a change, new culture, new energy, new resources, head over to oakwin.com/join, type in VRP 2020. That's oakwin.com/join, type in VRP 2020. Not only do you get to meet Michael Morgan and the gang, the bigwigs over at Oakwin, you get a huge incentive for first going to oakwin.com/join, typing in VRP 2020.